prison is a place of punishment and reflection, two themes that are pretty common across religions. So it may not be surprising that many prisoners turn to faith during their time behind bars.
Religious prisoners, however, can be seen as less than genuine, using a show of faith to gain privileges or get out of prison early.
Our guest Joshua Dubler spent 6 years studying religion in a maximum security prison. He says American prisons may well be the most religiously diverse places in the world.
Joshua Dubler is an assistant professor of religion at the University of Rochester, and he's the author of Down in the Chapel, Religious Life in an American Prison. And Joshua, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you spent a week watching and participating in the religious life at a prison in Pennsylvania. Tell us where you were and who you spent time with.
So the book takes place in the chapel of Graterford Prison, which is a maximum security prison about 35 miles from Philadelphia that houses maybe 3,500 men.
And who did you meet there?
The central characters are the chapel regulars. So there's this interfaith chapel, and over the course of any given week, and this is the diversity claim, you have something like 12 officially recognized denominations that host something like 55 or 60 worship sessions, Bible studies, musical group rehearsals. So the central characters are drawn from those people, and in particular from the 15 or so prisoners who work in the chapel, who earn between 19 and 41 cents an hour working as janitors and clerks. So those are the central characters of the book.
Now, you don't use their real names, but you did get close to a trio of guys in there. You want to tell us about them?
Yeah, the central characters, Baraka, Al, and Teddy, all of them from South Philadelphia. Teddy's been in prison since the 80s, Al since the 70s, and Baraka longer than I've been alive. I'm 39 now. So they're all from South Philadelphia. They're all there for homicide. Baraka is goes back to the Nation of Islam. He hasn't been in the Nation of Islam since 1975 when Elijah Muhammad died, but he retains a kind of political, sociological orientation. That's true of a lot of the older prisoners, but it's been kind of out of fashion. Al used to be in the Nation of Islam, although now he's a Christian, and Teddy is also a Christian.
Now, you walk into any place of faith in America that's not behind bars, and you're going to find differing levels of commitment and engagement with the faith. What did you find in the chapel and amongst the various faiths in this prison?
Right. I mean, as a sort of basic question or point of inquiry, I'm less interested in judging the kind of level of commitment of people in their hearts, and I think it's more of interest that it's such a common sense kind of knee-jerk assumption that prisoners are faking it. I think that's interesting because it tells us a lot about how we think about religion. That is, that real religion is this kind of fixed state of conviction, and how we think about prisoners, which is basically as people who we define by virtue of their crime. So when someone when someone is practicing a religion, we take them to be avowing a commitment to being good, then we kind of assume that they're faking it. As a point of practice, most of the men in Graterford's chapel will tell you some version of something like a prison is a place where you have to know who you are, because if you don't know what you're about, someone else will try to make you about what they're about. And so for that reason, my religious faith is really fixed. I'm really committed to what I'm committed to. That's the story that they tell, and it does seem, I end up feeling somewhat as a kind of secular pluralist, as if I'm, waffling in the wind a little bit compared to the sort of force and fixity of their convictions.
So why do you think they said that in prison you have to know who you are, and that whatever the answer to that is made them stronger in their faith?
I mean, first and foremost, they're saying that because there's this guy who's there who's not a prisoner and who's asking them those kind of questions. And so speaking, they are authorities about prison life. And so while I was wary to generalize, most of them were quite quick to generalize. As for the strength of the faith, I mean, I'm reluctant to kind of make a Marxist move and say that religious beliefs are nothing but social circumstances. But, you know, I think it is the case that if you think about it developmentally, of you come to prison, early on, you have to figure out where you stand. Early on, and that's socially during the day. You're alone at night, and you have to confront your thoughts about what you've done and where your life is headed. And because of the accidents of the First Amendment and because of the way that the Free Exercise Clause came to be interpreted in the mid to late 20th century, you know, we protect the rights of prisoners to practice their religions. So, whereas, you know, during the 60s and 70s, there was a whole lot going on in prisons in terms of programming. There's a lot less of that now, but because of that legacy of the First Amendment, those religious opportunities are as available as ever.
Now, if you look at the great literature about prison, you know, thinking specifically, I guess, right now about Dostoevsky, you look at themes of crime and punishment and then redemption. Did you see these guys being interested in that theme with religion, or are they interested, you know, in going down sort of the philosophical rabbit holes or somewhere in between?
It's funny. I had the opportunity to teach. The 6 year figure that you cite, the first, you know, couple were field work, and then I stuck around in the prison because Villanova University, the Catholic university, has a BA program, and I taught a class on Freud, Nietzsche, and Dostoevsky, and actually got to read Crime and Punishment, and was kind of shocked that they didn't quite buy Raskolnikov's religious conversion at the end. But the group of men who take classes is a different subculture than the men in the chapel, although there is some overlap. The story of redemption is, you know, that is for many of them the central story. That's because they are with, you know, their conceptualization of who they are is informed by that idea that many of us share, that they are defined by what they did. And so they are adamant, most of them, many of them in the chapel, about saying it is through my faith, it is through my religious practice that I am not who I once was. That's very important to them. Simultaneously, you do have sort of more open-ended, philosophically minded types. I mean, it's perverse. I mean, there's everything in the prison is so perverse and weird, right? But there's something that the graduate student and the life prisoner has in common, which is that there aren't many walks of life where you have the time and the resources to read endlessly. But I did have that in common with some of these men.
So I guess you could view a prison as in a microcosm of religious plurality, which you see, you know, writ large in the rest of the world. Do these guys get along with each other?
Yeah. I mean, this is so the culture of the chapel is really the culture of the lifers, and the lifers, you know, this is where they live. And they stand to lose everything if things get out of hand. You know, these are institutions that are control is really the word of the age, and people are constantly concerned that they're going to get placed in solitary confinement, that they are going to be shipped off to another prison in the state, or even to another prison in another state. So you know, they are invested. You know, the day-to-day management of the prison really falls to the lifers in a lot of ways. So yeah, they get along. There are conflicts. There are conflicts, intra-religious conflicts, say between different Muslim sects, and those conflicts sort of trace back to conflicts that existed on the street 20, 30 years ago. You know, especially the lifers. The lifers are there because of homicides that took place, and these are people that were in different gangs back in the street 30 years ago. So the allegiances of the street kind of carry on in these religious subgroups.
We're talking right now with Joshua Dubler. He's a professor of religion at the University of Rochester and the author of the book Down in the Chapel. And we're talking about what religious life is like in prison. And our guest says it's a surprisingly rich slice of spiritual life. And we want to know, do you have an experience of faith behind bars? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. or you can email us at talk@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking right now about what spiritual life looks like behind bars. Our guest spent a week in a maximum security prison in Pennsylvania and paints a picture of a diverse expression of faith in America from behind bars. And if you have an experience of faith and religion behind bars, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Joshua, you painted some pictures about the people you got to know as you were behind bars and some of the reasons they were invested in life in the chapel. And I want to know what conclusions you drew. You're a scholar of religions. You identify as a secular Jew. What conclusions did you draw about what this had to say about these people and the way we run prisons?
I mean, the book is in structure, I think, reads a bit like a novel, and it's pretty open-ended, and I want the reader to kind of wrestle with these things themselves, but there's an uncomfortable and obvious conclusion, which is that if you look at how the practices have changed over the years, and if you think about, Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam and a kind of collectivist political orientation. This is the kind of orientation that the central character Baraka still has. If you look at that and the predominant forms of religious practice today, in terms of Islam, in at Greaterford, it's something called Salafism, which is sort of the global movement of which Wahhabism is a part. So it's very concerned with personal purity practices, and you see similar things on the Christian side, very much about individual practice. And so what you find is that this kind of collectivist political ways of being religious that fit with the 1960s have totally fallen out of fashion for these more individualist forms. And the uncomfortable thing is how well that meshes with shifts in how we run our prisons from the 1960s and 70s, where there was a lot of experimentation with empowering prisoners and with democratic procedures, to the growth of prisons over the last 40 years. Since 1970, this is true nationwide and in Pennsylvania and in Wisconsin, the prison population has grown something like 700%, and the philosophy has moved from one of rehabilitation to incapacitation, what's often called warehousing, that we're just about keeping these people forever, and sentences have gotten longer and longer. So in the 1970s, a lifer in Pennsylvania could expect to receive commutation by the time he or she had served 20 years. And again, the same thing is true in Wisconsin. I was reading the blog post by a life prisoner named Harlan Richards before I came on, who describes a very similar story where lifers in Wisconsin used to be parole eligible in the 1980s after 11 years, and now it's 30 years before you're potentially parole eligible. And this is, social norms change, and we think that what we're doing now is just the way things have always been. But in fact, the experiment we've been engaging in collectively over the past 40 years of incarcerating now, 2.3 million Americans is unprecedented.
So how do you think American civilization should be judged according to its prisons?
I mean, it's a paradox, right? We care about freedoms, and we care about them deeply. And one of our core freedoms that we point to, when we tell the story of why are we here, why did our forebears leave England, it's about religious freedom. And we do protect religious freedoms in the prison in a way that is somewhat remarkable. I mean, the First Amendment right to free religious exercise doesn't allow you to do whatever it is you want to do, but it protects your conscience, and it protects in many cases your religious observance. And so whereas in 1970 at Greaterford's Chapel you could have been a practicing Protestant, Catholic, or Jew, now you can be any number of these 12 different denominations. And that matters, and that's real. That isn't nothing. I think we can feel pleased with the ways that we try to make room for religious minorities. But simultaneously, this bit of religious freedom is taking place in a monument to American unfreedom. And I don't think Americans generally think about the fact that while we have 5% of the world's population, we have 25% of the world's prisoners, and that speaks volumes about whether or not we're living up to our ideals.
Josh, we've only got about 30 seconds left, but you spent 6 days with these men, and you joined in their conversations and their debates. Did this change you?
Yeah, I mean, well, this was, I spent a year and a half intensely there, and, you know, I think about my time there in some way, and this is in a secular way, it has a family resemblance with when they talk about how they took their shahada on such and such a date, or the Holy Spirit filled them with such and such a date. Like, being religious, you can think of it, if you have a strong religious commitment, as you're trying to stay true to an important experience and who made you who you are. And certainly for me, this was such an experience, and I try to be true to it. And to try to represent these men who have been incarcerated for so long.
Well, Joshua, thank you so much for being on and talking about it with us today.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Joshua Dubler, an assistant professor of religion at the University of Rochester and the author of the book Down in the Chapel.
The news is coming up next. Then we'll hear about the Honor the Earth tour in Wisconsin, including the Indigo Girls, who we'll talk to in just a few minutes. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday, and Ian Knauer joins us with a look at great ways to use fresh honey.
First, an iron mine in northern Wisconsin continues to be a hot topic, and it's brought the Honor the Earth tour to Wisconsin this weekend. Featuring music by the Indigo Girls, the tour aims to draw attention to environmental issues facing Native American tribes around the country.
Earlier today, I talked to the Indigo Girls, Amy Ray and Emily Saliers, about the tour and why they're here in Wisconsin. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah.
And Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So Honor the Earth started 20 years ago. Emily, when you and Winona LaDuc and the other folks involved started it, what was the goal?
Well, we were at an Earth Day concert at Foxborough Stadium in Massachusetts, and Amy started speaking with Winona LaDuc after she had spoken to the crowd, and we had been doing some sort of mainstream environmental activism with groups like Greenpeace and other mainstream groups. And then after talking with Winona, both of us realized that we could only from that point on begin to view our environmental, view environmentalism through the lens of the indigenous perspective. And so Honor the Earth was created with Winona and some other Native American activists. And then Amy and I became sort of a liaison and the musical liaison between Indian and non-Indian communities to focus on different issues like cultural issues and environmental sustainability. And now we find ourselves, as we have been over the course of Honor the Earth, focused on environmental justice issues, which brings us to Wisconsin, you know, and the proposed Gugibic Taconic Mine, which we find a horrible idea. That's why we're here, and that's a little bit of history of Honor the Earth and what we focus on.
And Amy, as Emily just mentioned, the big issue here in Wisconsin in the environment is mining. Is this something you're seeing not just here in Wisconsin, but as a tribal and environmental issue around the country?
Yeah, I mean, we've been seeing this for years. You know, it's been going on for, I mean, this has been going on for so long. It's like we did some work with mining issues a long time ago in Wisconsin, with another mine, and we've worked in, you know, various parts of the country. But I mean, I would say that right now, there's been, to me, there seems like there's an aggressive sort of pro-mining stance generally, and I think it's because, you know, we have the tar sands in Canada, we have the pipelines we're talking about, we have fracking we're talking about, we have all these different forms of mining, and I think one of the things that's happened is we had a bad economic time, and there's a real need for jobs. And I think we always talk about jobs versus no jobs when we're talking about mining. We definitely have newer technologies, but also the resources have been gutted a bit. So we're trying to extract, ores and ores and minerals from, things that we didn't think we could get them from before. So you end up having, a taconite mine where we're getting iron ore out of taconite. You end up having tar sands where we're getting oil out of tar sands. And, we've advanced in our technology to be able to do that, but at the same time, it's more destructive because you're getting, you're having to go through a lot more resources to get a lot less mineral and ore. And I think generally the picture that we've seen, though, has been that over and over again, treaty rights have been ignored and Native people haven't been asked to the table to negotiate and to talk about the environmental impact on their area, as well as community people haven't been asked. I think what happens is the government says, we have, like in Wisconsin, for instance, they had all these great protections, and then all of a sudden, Scott Walker was like, we need to streamline this process, and all of a sudden, before you know it, there's new legislation and gutting the environmental parts of the old mining law. And so I think that's happening everywhere, because I think they want to expedite the mining because they don't want to have a light shown on it. They don't want to have the impact on the ecosystem shown. And I think what I think we should do is, step back and look at these more and look at other ways we have to get energy and look at the impact that these mines have and the long-term effect, because it's great to get jobs short-term, but if you're ruining the environment, you're basically trading in your public health and your ecosystem health and things like ecotourism and all the people that come to the, great part of northern Wisconsin to do fishing and hunting and snowmobiling and everything that happens up here. And I think you trade that in for a short-term amount of jobs, and it's not as many jobs as you think it'd be because technology is so advanced that you don't need as many jobs. And so that, to me, is like what we're seeing all over the, all over the country in different mining areas, and constantly over and over again, the tribes will get left out of the equation.
Emily, as you travel the country doing the Honor the Earth tour, do you get a sense that everybody's kind of fighting their own local battle, or is there a sense that people need to make connections from state to state, country to country on these issues?
I mean, I think in this digital information world, it is sometimes hard to make the larger picture connections, but it's one of our goals is to, obviously local communities, when it happens in your own backyard, it's when you tend to get the most fired up, and then to have a holistic approach to making the connections and seeing how this is a widespread, these environmental issues and our relationships with the tribes and, these widespread issues affect all of us. But what you start with the communities and the voice of the people who live there and those who are affected by these issues, and then you connect the dots. And as I say, it's more difficult to speak succinctly about a holistic approach and the problems, but it's definitely important that we make those connections. In a short attention span culture, as I say, that's a great challenge. But the most important thing, first and foremost, is to try to stop the mines and stop the environmental destruction. And this mine here in Wisconsin is a terrible example of something that is, as Amy said, has been going on because of all the reasons she listed, but it is something that can be stopped. And, if you want to talk about a big picture, when you're talking about the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa, you're talking about potential genocide of a people. And this is huge. And you can make a link to the Syrian war. What are we potentially going into another country because we're so offended by the use of chemical weaponry? And yet, back here in Wisconsin, you're facing with the genocide of a tribal people. And what about that? It's the same sort of destruction and ending of life through environmental devastation. Those are the dots and points that we need to connect worldwide. But we need to start in our local communities and with the tribes and stop the mines and then get to the table to discuss the big issues.
Looking back at the history of the Honor the Earth tour, when you started it 20 years ago, Amy, did you think you'd still be at it 20 years later?
I'll say that we hoped we would, if it was needed. I mean, obviously, you hope at some point that you don't need Honor the Earth, but or that it just becomes like a celebratory group. But I think, you know, these are all the stuff we're working on is pretty long term, and we jumped into the environmental world of activism, of Native activism, when they were already well underway working on issues that we're still working on. I mean, they come and they go, and but it's the same paradigm that you're fighting, which is, you know, putting profit before the health of the ecosystem and the health of the human community. And so, you know, I think that what we did know is that we would have a long-term vision and we would stick with it as long as we could and as long as the group could exist. But we sort of exist at the behest of all of the other Native groups doing work, because what we really do is we try to amplify Native groups across the Americas that are doing environmental work. And so as long as they're doing work, we're going to be here to amplify them and to fund them in as much as we can. And that's kind of what our goal was.
And I wanted to ask both of you, Emily, first, has your involvement with Honor the Earth and other activism changed the way you create music in Indigo Girls or on your own?
That's a good question. I think that everything that you're involved with that speaks to your soul and to your sort of reason for, or your belief in your part in a larger community affects your art, and in ways that sometimes can be traced clearly, like if a song in its lyrics deals specifically with an environmental issue or a celebration of the land or our connectivity to the land and its peoples. And then sometimes it can't be articulated. It's just something that stirs within your soul that affects your art. There's no doubt that these long-term relationships with indigenous groups and even non-indigenous groups who are fighting the same battles to protect the environment are things that are very inspiring. They're sometimes disheartening. It's the great struggles, you know, over resources and what we need to protect and celebrate. All those things play in your art, whether specifically in the lyrics or whether in the way it moves your approach to writing. So there's no doubt that this has had an effect. And then just plain and simple, all the amazing people we've met through this work with Honor the Earth, and just having good people like that around, it keeps your creative fires fired, you know? So when you sit down to write a song, all that stuff comes out. It's a beautiful gift.
Amy, anything to add to that?
Oh, I think that pretty much sums it up.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. Amy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for being here, and thanks for being on the air. We appreciate it.
And Emily, thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much.
That was Amy Ray and Emily Saliers, otherwise known as the Indigo Girls, and they're co-founders of Honor the Earth.
They're playing tonight in Madison at the Capitol Theater, tomorrow in St. Paul, Minnesota at the O'Shaughnessy Auditorium, Sunday at Big Top Chautauqua.
Coming up, it's Food Friday, and food writer Ian Knauer joins us to celebrate National Honey Month. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Bee lovers rejoice, for September is National Honey Month. So for this Food Friday, we celebrate the sweet stuff from our little stripey friends with Ian Knauer.
Ian's a food writer who spent 10 years at Gourmet Magazine. These days, he's running The Family Farm in Pennsylvania, where he writes, cooks, gardens, and keeps bees. He's also hosting a new PBS series. It's due out in November, called The Farm, and that's named after his cookbook by the same name. Ian, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back.
So September is National Honey Month, and I guess the question is, what's not to like about that?
Nothing. It's the sweetest month all year.
So you keep bees at your farm in Pennsylvania, something that's catching on around the country. Tell us a little bit about what it's like being up close and personal with the source of your honey.
Keeping bees is probably one of the most intimate ways to get in touch with nature and with yourself. If you know a beekeeper, chances are they're pretty calm, because it's true. I mean, this old maxim about how bees can smell fear is absolutely true. Well, I don't know if they actually smell it. I'm not sure that they have noses, but they can sense it. And I notice a huge difference in my hive when I go in. If I'm in a bad mood or if I'm stressed, the bees also become stressed. So what you learn as a beekeeper is to really relax yourself, and the bees will follow right with you, because you don't like to get stung. And so when you learn how to make yourself calm, the bees will follow suit. And if you do that enough, then you can transfer that out of the hive and into your regular life. So, you know, beekeepers tend to be pretty chill.
So it'll be the Zen of beekeeping, your next book.
Exactly.
I always want to keep bees. I'm tempted by it, but my kids keep voting me down. They think they're going to get stung or something. And I keep telling them, you know, bees are our friends, guys. You don't need to worry about it. But it sounds like you're saying it's sort of more about you than it is about the bees.
Oh, very, very much so. I mean, they are sensitive to some other external factors, like the weather, for instance. They don't really like it when it's rainy and cloudy. They get a little cranky. So you just avoid them at that time. And, you know, you steer clear and you let them have their space. And then when it's sunny out and nice like it is today over in this part of the country, today is a perfect day to go into the hive. And they're actually really happy to see you. So as long as you don't, you know, egg them on and you know how to be sensitive to the bees, then the bees will just return the favor.
Let's get to the eating part now. I keep honey around. I eat it in fits and starts. Usually when I go to get it, I have to kind of chisel it out with a butter knife. How much of a difference does it make to have fresh honey?
Well, honey never goes bad. So let's start from that end. Even in some excavations of tombs in Egypt, they found jars of honey that was still good.
Wow.
There's just so much sugar in it that bacteria can't set in, so it doesn't rot. Now, it does crystallize, so that's what you experience when you have to chip it out. That doesn't mean it's bad at all. In fact, a lot of people prefer it that way. It's much more spreadable. Or if you like your honey liquefied, you can always just warm up your jar in some warm water or even stick it in the microwave for a couple seconds, and it'll become a liquid again. Now, that said, fresh honey is its own wonderful, just incredible thing. And if you get it right from the hive or you get it from a local farmer or a local beekeeper who has just taken the honey, it tastes totally different than it does 6 months later or a year later. And you can really taste those flowers. It's very, very floral. So if you get a chance to either keep your own bees or you know a beekeeper, see if you can get your hands on some really fresh honey.
So judging by the varieties of honey available at my farmer's market, it seems like you can literally kind of taste what it is that the bees are eating. Do you find that?
I think in some cases, yeah. I think with orange flower honey, for instance, it really tastes like oranges to me. It's very citrus. Now, when it comes to something like lavender honey, I don't actually taste lavender. I think it's delicious, but I really have to squint and use my imagination to get lavender flavor from the honey. But, you know, I think it really depends. Buckwheat honey, of course, is its own really dark, almost molasses-like flavor. And then chestnut honey, if you ever get your hands on some chestnut honey, especially from Italy, it's almost funky. I mean, there's something really ripe about it. So it varies from location to location and, of course, from flower to flower. And you can get such a wide range of flavors of honey that you can play with them. You know, it's fun to play with those different flavors.
We got a sneak peek at your PBS series called The Farm, and we got a look at you eating just some biscuits with honey drizzled on them. Is that the best way to enjoy some honey?
If you have honey fresh from the hive, you know, and it was just harvested, then that's the way that you want to eat it, just unadulterated on a very plain canvas, like a biscuit is a great example of that, or some toast. You really get the nuanced flavors of that fresh honey. But I also like to cook with honey, not only in sweet dishes, but savory dishes too. It can be a really fun ingredient, a nice way to add balance and a little bit of sweetness to a savory dish.
Well, now, speaking of recipes and savory dishes, you shared one with us, and it's one that, of course, employs honey. Honey chipotle ribs. Can you tell us a bit about that recipe?
This is basically everybody's favorite this time of year. You get a really nice balance because you have those chipotle peppers, which are smoky and a little spicy, as the base of this rub that goes on the ribs. And then to balance that out, I add a little fresh lime juice and, of course, some honey. And so you really get a complete flavor profile here. You get the acidity, the sweetness, the smokiness, and the heat. And, of course, you know, ribs all by themselves are pretty delicious things. So this just bumps up the flavor by like 1,000%. It's a really simple marinade to put together. You basically just chop your chipotles and whisk it all together, and then you drizzle it on the ribs and then cook them in the oven. I like to cook them in like a foil packet. That basically means that they steam in the marinade and in their own juices for like an hour and three quarters or so until they're just falling off the bone. And then I undo the foil package, and I either grill them to finish them, or I put them under the broiler for like 4 or 5 minutes just to get a little brown on top. It's one of those recipes that takes a couple hours, but it's not active time. You can throw them in the oven and then forget about them and then come back at dinner time. So it's actually really easy.
And can you send some of those ribs over for us right now?
It's kind of cruel to be talking about this as we enter the dinner hour. I see Rob salivating over there.
Literally.
Yeah.
Can you put that on other stuff besides ribs? Chicken, shrimp?
Yeah, it'd be great on, grilled chicken would be amazing with that. You could just stand at the grill and brush it on as you're cooking.
Nice.
You don't even need to soak it in there like a marinade for a long time.
And I should point out, this one is up on the Central Time Facebook page right now. So if you want to cook this over the weekend, get some of those summery flavors and that honey in there, it's right there for you.
And if people at home have some honey handy and they want to work it into a recipe tonight or this weekend, any good places to look to put some honey in a recipe?
Well, I think something really, really simple and also shockingly sophisticated is to use it on a cheese plate. And so what I like to do is I like to take a pear or even an apple that's really ripe and slice it thinly and put some ricotta cheese on top of that, some nice fresh billowy ricotta, and then drizzle that with some honey and then even sprinkle it with a little smoked paprika. So, again, you've got all these complementary flavors that really round out the flavor of the dish when you take a bite of everything. So that's a really simple way to use it. A way that might be a little more complex is to replace maple syrup with honey. Like, let's say you like to make granola at home. You could add honey instead of maple to your granola mixture. And you'll definitely get some of that honey flavor in there, but it won't be overwhelming. So I think those are two really simple ways to incorporate honey.
Well, Ian, thanks again for being here, and say hello to your bees for us.
Oh, I will. I'm sure they'll say hi back.
Excellent. We've been talking to Ian Knauer. He's a food writer, beekeeper, of course, gardener, and host of the forthcoming PBS series called The Farm, based on his cookbook by the same name. Coming up on Monday on Central Time, astronomer Phil Plait will be joining us. He's going to talk about the northern lights. He's going to talk about what they are and whether or not this might be a good year to actually see the northern lights if you don't live in the far north of Wisconsin.
And he'll tell us why they happen, too. He's always a lot of fun on those astronomy stories. Also, we'll hear about how our emails and online accounts are easily hacked and what we can do to protect ourselves.
Also, we'll talk to a former Apostle Island historian about lighthouses on Lake Superior.
That's all coming up Monday on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at the history of censorship in America.
Stick around. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.